Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Back with us is Dan Clark. He is from the Times Union in Albany. The Capital Confidential newsletter covers New York government and policy, and we can talk as fellow journalists in a way that we're going to try to give you a fair shot at the information, which is why I love having Dan on the program. Dan Clark, welcome back to the Capital Connection.
Always happy to be here.
And I should say that if people want to get to you, how do they write to you?
So the easiest way is just to go to capitalconfidential.com, capital with an O, and my contact is on there. And you can sign up for our newsletter in the meantime.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. And then you'll be up to date. Well, obviously, there is still not a final budget in place. I went back and looked at some of the sticking points that you had done in an article. This is back in March on the 23rd. Have there been any changes to New York's energy and emission mandates?
No. That's the thing.
That's the thing.
The governor's proposing them, but lawmakers don't really want to change them. That's part of the conversation right now. And the problem with it is that we don't know the exact details of the proposal that's on the table. The governor has transmitted it to lawmakers, but neither the governor nor lawmakers have made it public to us. And by extension, the public. So we don't actually know what's being discussed behind closed doors.
What we do know is there's this 2019 climate law, the CLCPA, right? The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act.
You got it.
That set some really high goals, probably the most substantial climate law in the country. And then there have been a certain number of things happening as a result of changes in an administration in Washington and the turn away from environmental protection. You have NYSERDA, the authority, Research and Development Authority, Energy Research and Development Authority, sending out a memo saying, slow down here. If we are going to implement this law, we're going to end up costing New Yorkers, one estimate was up to $4,000 a year if we do this, and we can't just leave it, otherwise we're breaking the law, so we need to adjust our goals. Now, that's like, you know, the equivalent of pulling the pin on a grenade for environmental advocates, and there has been a resulting explosion in Albany.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what the governor really wants to do is she wants to move the goalposts back a few years.
Right.
We don't know how many years necessarily. She's saying that the state can't get to these mandates under the law to reduce emissions and produce more electricity from renewable sources by 2030, or that $4,000 number will be the result. Now, environmental advocates have questioned that math, saying that the administration hasn't actually explained it and that it represents a worst case scenario in the state's energy planning process. Now, it is true by objective data that if you or I were to electrify our house, our energy bills would go down. That being said, it would take a heck of a lot of money to electrify your home. I know because I just had to replace my gas furnace with another gas furnace because it was too expensive to go to a heat pump, unfortunately. So those are the kinds of questions that lawmakers are facing at the Capitol right now. How do they continue to incentivize people to electrify their homes and their lives, their transportation, without those costs going up? And as you mentioned, the federal government, there's challenges there as well. The tax credits to allow people to install solar, to allow people to buy electric vehicles, expired. So people don't have that help anymore. So there really isn't an incentive other than a moral one to go for it.
And, you know, there is some benefit to pushing this legislation back. The governor won't be governor anymore.
Well, looking in your crystal ball, sure.
My cynical crystal ball. Yeah. But the other part of this is really that we can't make it that fast to these goals. And
yes. So
how are we going to get the carbon out of the atmosphere? Well, one area that the governor now has ramped up is nuclear.
Yep, exactly. And the problem with nuclear, though, is that it takes at least a few years to get online.
And maybe a decade.
Exactly. And I think the lowest estimate that I had seen from the governor was about 7 years from last year. So that's not an immediate solution. The utility companies are pushing to make gas equipment more efficient, saying, you know, we can't get off gas right now, but we can make it a little less dirty, so to say. It's not quite as dirty as oil, but it's not as clean as something like solar or wind power. So They're trying to take kind of a middle-of-the-road approach that benefits their companies that the governor says will then benefit the residents in terms of their utility bills. Now, we don't know if that's actually going to pan out. This is all kind
that's
of
right.
just predicting whether this is going to happen or not. We don't know if a renewable development project is going to be canceled tomorrow, for example. So it's a process of years of planning that they're trying to figure out in just a few weeks.
And it seems like they're just not going to go there. And
yeah.
the there is make the utilities pay for their own upgrades. Make the utilities eat the costs and not pass them on to the consumer.
Well, exactly right. So New York does have a process for approving these utility rates. So part of that process is the Public Service Commission, a state entity, actually approves what can basically be explained as a margin of profit. If everything goes exactly as planned, they're guaranteed to get this much profit. Now, the governor and lawmakers in the legislature don't want to tinker with that too much because they believe that these companies are entitled to a profit. What that profit looks like is another question. Some lawmakers have said, hey, why don't we exempt certain costs from those rate increases, like maybe legal fees? Mm. They're bills for attorneys that are actually fighting for these rate increases. So they're trying to work around the edges, but there isn't really a whole scale proposal on the table right now or this year at all that would immediately lower anybody's utility bills.
It seems like that's the ultimate sticking point, right? They
yes.
have to work out because it's a law and they can't just leave it like this. They've been ordered to do that.
That's exactly it.
All right. Well, sticking a little bit with environmental, and that's Environmental Quality Review, the state Environmental Quality Review Act, or CQR, which basically is the governor wants more housing. States in general are in desperate need of housing. But in New York, we have all these environmental quality reviews that go on. So mm-hmm. they want to sort of cherry pick those areas that they think are more nuisance, put it in those terms, more of a nuisance to construction than those that like sewage or other things that would require a quality review.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a statewide law. It was created in 1975 at a time when there was a lot of development going on, but not a lot of attention paid to the environmental impact of that development. Now, since then, municipalities have really taken up doing their own environmental reviews because, as you and I both know, there's always been this struggle in New York between locality and state control. So a lot of localities say, hey, we trust you, but we're going to take a second look at this. What the governor is saying is, let's take the state out of that a little bit. Let's leave it up to the local municipalities to make these decisions. We can take some of that time off the table. Now, it's not a huge amount of time. We toured a development with the governor this week in Troy. The developer there, I asked him how much time it would shave off the project in total. The project has been going for about 4 years now. He said it would have shaved off 6 months. So we're certainly not talking about something that would light speed accelerate housing development, but it would help boost it.
Well, we go from there now to something that plays well, I would think, with New Yorkers, and that is reduce my car insurance costs. But it's interesting when you get in the weeds there as to who's throwing the money around.
Oh, my gosh. This is the major sticking point in budget negotiations. And it's one of these rare instances at the state capitol where you have both sides that are extremely well funded. On one side, you have the car insurance companies, which stand to benefit from this proposal. The governor's thinking is that if they benefit, they're going to pass on those savings to the policyholders. There's nothing in her proposal that would require that, though. So these companies could just pocket the cash.
Well, why would they do that? They would want to help their customers in the state of New York, right?
I wish, believe me, if you could see my car insurance bill.
Me too.
There is an excess profits law that prevents them from making too much over a 6-year period, though. The governor is saying maybe we should look at lowering that cap a little bit, but again, that proposal's not on the table. That's another, maybe we could do this. Maybe we should do this. It's not something that's actually being discussed.
And when you say something like that, that opens the coffers for the lobbyists to drop their money into your campaign.
Exactly. And that's where we get to the trial lawyers, which is the other side of the equation. They're the people that you see those billboards when you're going down 787 right. and 90 that say, hey, if you're injured, give us a call. They don't specify what kind of injury because under New York State's laws, they're interpreted so liberally that really in a lot of these occasions, anybody can get a payout for almost any reason. There isn't a high bar there. So the governor's trying to tighten them a little bit, a lot of it by the view of lawmakers in the legislature. That being said, they say some crash victims would really stand to be negatively impacted by this. There's one proposal that would mm-hmm. prevent damages from somebody who is found to be more at fault for a crash. Even if both parties are at fault, maybe I don't know, somebody turned right on red when they weren't supposed to, and the other person's texting and driving. Whoever is found to be more at fault in that situation, they're the ones that won't get any damages, even though the other person was also doing something illegal.
Still a negotiation. Nothing been decided on that yet, right?
Not even a little bit close to a deal on that one.
Okay, here's one the governor's been talking about for a while. Protests, buffer zones around houses of worship. That one I can see passing.
That one I can too. The problem with that one is disagreement over the distance. The governor wants to put it 25 feet from houses of worship. Now, why 25 feet? Because we've seen historically some other buffer zones created around different locations, like reproductive health care facilities. A buffer zone of 35 feet was struck down in court in one of these cases. And that's why lawmakers are pushing for the 25 feet. They think if they go further, then it'll get struck down in court. Because we know civil rights groups are planning to initiate some sort of lawsuit if this passes. And it is likely that it will. Some lawmakers will say 100 feet. That is almost definitely not going to survive in court if it goes up against a challenge just based on past legal precedent. That being said, it all depends on how it's written. Anytime you bring something to court, you can tweak the language a little bit to maybe make it survive a lawsuit like that.
Yeah, and a word could be a huge difference.
Exactly. In law, the word shall versus must can be a big deal.
Huge, and can set precedent. Well, okay, so now I want to use the phrase that's been used all over the Capitol and usually shouted, tax the rich!
Dan I didn't know Clark. Which one you were going to go for.
There's so many, right? But I've been hearing that around the Capitol these days.
Yeah.
Of course, we're speaking with Dan Clark, Capitol Confidential, the Times Union. You know, a lot of this comes out of the campaign of Zohran Mamdani, but
yes.
More recently. But, you know, we've had the 1% and the issue of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer since politics has begun. And in New York, it's an issue. The question is whether to tax the rich. The governor, of course, has been leaning away from that. I see now there's been some movement, maybe not on their income, but maybe some other way to raise revenue, as they like to say.
Exactly. The governor wants to impose a tax on second homes in New York City. So if somebody...
The pied-à-terre.
Exactly, the pied-à-terre tax. That's the big proposal. It was first proposed in 2015 by Democrats in the state legislature. They didn't have the majority at the time. They tried for it again in 2019 when they gained the majority. Governor Cuomo's office rejected the proposal because they said it would be difficult to enforce. And I mean, when you look at it from a tax perspective, that's not necessarily untrue. If I'm an ultra rich person living in Florida and I have my second home in New York City, how is New York City going to go to Florida and collect those taxes if I just say, I don't want to pay that? There's no way. I mean, you could bring them to court, but at the end of the day, rich people have money to do things. They have a lot of money to pay a lot of lawyers.
So is this completely ineffective legislation? Should it go through?
You know, I don't think it's ineffective. It just depends on how much we see in compliance of it. Everybody that, you know, from time as told has tried to avoid their taxes for one reason or another, and the state has tried to go after them. The federal government has tried to go after them. Often successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully.
Wow, more to come on that one. Well, we do have, in the meantime, an election year, and you've got a governor who's, you know, facing a major challenger, but how major will it be? We've just seen some controversy with Bruce Blakeman. Why don't you bring us up to date? I know you somehow were able to get a look at their numbers.
Oh, yeah. I got to look at his financial disclosure statements, which there's nothing exciting in there. It's really just his salary as county executive, his wife's salary as a family court judge in New York, and they have plenty of investments.
What do you make as county executive in Nassau County?
I believe the range was from $150,000 to
$250,000.
And I believe he makes around $230,000, but I'm not completely sure about that, so just stick to the range.
Just
anybody
keeping
listening.
It under the maximum,
exactly.
Just so he doesn't get maximum criticism.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, his campaign is very different from gubernatorial campaigns that we've seen in the past.
Sure is.
A lot of them have tried to really swing hard up in Albany because a lot of the journalists that are at the state capitol cover publications that go statewide. They have a statewide reach. Bruce Blakeman is kind of going here and there for his campaign, and something unique about his campaign is he's not advising these appearances. So his campaign appeared in Westchester County, for example, just over the weekend. They didn't say that they were going to be there, but they were there. So it doesn't give journalists a great opportunity to go talk to him and get his message out there to voters who might be interested in voting for somebody who is not Kathy Hochul.
But it does allow him to go directly to voters, Avoid the press, not have them ask him sticky questions about the president of the United States, including all the way back to January 6th, and whether he believes the election was stolen there, which I think is a fair game question for any politician who supports this current president.
Sure.
And so you can see where the strategy is, but it doesn't help him with name recognition.
It doesn't. And in today's day and age, somebody could run this kind of campaign very effectively if they got on something like TikTok or Instagram, where they could really leverage social media. We saw that with New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani. The difference is that New York City geographically, while it is a very big place, it's not quite as big as New York State. So as much as Zohran was going on social media, he was doing appearances at places where journalists could show up at. Even if, for example, somebody was in Queens and he was doing an event in the Bronx, It's possible that a reporter could get there before it's over. With Blakeman, we don't know where he is until he's already been there. So there's no chance.
Have you talked to him at all?
I have spoken to him. Not recently. It's been at least a few months, unfortunately.
Do you think he's sort of labeling different media sites as friends and enemies and then picking accordingly?
I don't think so, personally. I think that he just doesn't have a great handle on a media strategy. He's done some podcasts here and there. So to me, what it looks like is that he's doing the appearances that he's invited to and not proactively reaching out to media outlets for interviews. He's not reaching out to editorial boards, for example, which is a huge part of any campaign across the state for somebody to get their name in every newspaper. Now, that being said, it is April. The election's in November. There's a lot of time for Bruce Blakeman to make up ground. And in the latest Siena poll, he was already further ahead than Lee Zeldin was in 2022. So as much as he's not really staging a very active campaign, the numbers are working in his favor so far.
How much of that do you think, Dan Clark, is just the general polarization that's out there? All you have to do is say GOP, Democrats, the people line up accordingly.
I think that's a big part of it. I think both the governor and Blakeman know that they have their base locked up. In New York, Democrats hold the majority party registration by far.
It's
2-1 Republican. Now, here's the thing. Republicans are not the second most largest voter group.
No,
it's independent voters.
Yeah. And not the independent party.
Exactly, because that doesn't exist in New York anymore.
Right.
So both of them have to figure out how they get those independent voters. And as we see, it switches month to month between who actually gets them and who doesn't get them. We've seen in the past, independent voters tend to go more conservative far out from an election because they really want to put pressure on Democrats. This is in New York, not everywhere. But they want to put pressure on Democrats to enact some sort of policy or some sort of platform that they
like
can
don't tax the rich.
Yeah, exactly. So it remains to be seen. The governor certainly has a lot of time to make her case as well. If you go to her website right now, she does not have a campaign platform. And she has said if she is reelected, she'll just continue doing what she's been trying to do, which is lower costs here and there. Now, she's done a very effective job at making progress on that issue in terms of people who have children. She's done things like trying to expand childcare this year, expanding the child tax credit, universal school meals. So in that sense, she has lowered costs. I think it's the people who either don't have children anymore, maybe they have grandchildren, but they don't have any financial responsibility for them, or people without children because they can't afford to have children.
Or those just the fact that these utility companies keep asking for rate increases all while she's doing this other stuff. And it's, give me a little here, take it away over here.
Yes, exactly. And the utility companies, I mean, that's a whole can of worms in terms of the legislature could do anything at any time to help with this issue.
Yes.
This is not an issue that has to be dealt with in the state budget. It's not an issue that has to go into the state constitution.
Right.
They could pass a law tomorrow that caps their profits even lower, but they will not do it.
Nope, they will not do it. Well, we have a comptroller of the state of New York, Tom DiNapoli. He's been there for a long time. He has
18 years.
Yeah, two challengers now. He's generally a well-liked guy. I don't see too much pushback even from the Republicans. But tell us about his challengers and how the race is shaping up.
Sure. So I think that this was actually born out of Zohran Mamdani's election. I think that people have seen Tom DiNapoli in office for 18 years, but the state comptroller's office has traditionally been one that isn't very exciting. It manages the state's money.
No, which is why he's been there for so long.
Exactly. It audits state agencies, but it does also do things that are very important. For example, during the COVID-19 pandemic, his office was the one that audited the nursing home deaths.
That's right.
And put out a report about that. So it's
Which was damaging to the governor of his own party.
Exactly. So it's not exactly a snooze fest. He has actually three challengers, which is funny that you said two, because the third one really isn't staging an active campaign. That's Adam Bundikadeko, I think is his name.
Yeah.
I'm not totally sure how to pronounce his last name. He's been a candidate for Congress in Brooklyn twice now. He's worked for some nonprofits here and there. Not very well known. The two that are considered the stronger challengers to him are Drew Warshaw, who was chief of staff at the Port Authority down in New York City and New Jersey, and he led a national housing nonprofit building affordable housing. And then the second one is Raj Goyal, who is has an interesting past in the sense that he was originally part of the Kansas state legislature. He moved to New York in the early 2010s, developed a tech legal company or legal tech company, so to say, decided that he wanted to get into politics here in New York, and now he's running for state controller. Now, all three of them have the same message. They say the state controller should be somebody who is like the governor out in public all the time, kind of putting on these not necessarily political events, but should be out there championing causes, advocating for things that voters might be interested in, that members of either party might be interested in. And they just don't see that from Tom DiNapoli right now. And they're not incorrect. Tom is somebody who likes to work from his office. He is somebody who is glued to a desk a lot of the time. He works with his staff. And as I've spoken to him one-on-one, he spends a lot of his time going over the work that his staff does so that he can understand it and then explain it to people like me who want to talk to him.
That's right.
So what I have said to his challengers are, do you want to take away from that kind of work and add different work? And they say, no, we want it all. I don't know if that's possible. I'm not in that office. So I think it'll be interesting if he is defeated. Do we see the nature of that office actually change, or did they get into that office and see, oh, this is why he acted that way? We just don't know.
One of the things that he gets criticized for, and it's a specific issue, and that's Israel, his investments in Israel.
Right.
A number of groups have come forward, and some have reached out to me because I talked to him one-on-one as well. And I've asked him about it for sure. And he says, well, it's, you know, I have a fiscal responsibility to the state of New York, and this is why I will continue to do this. But to their credit, they're saying, you know, why don't we pick where we're going to allow that money to go and not allow them, in their opinion, to fund a war? So are these other candidates on the Democrat, his challengers, are they bringing that up?
They are bringing that up. And not just that part of it. There is the investments in Israel. There is the investments in Palantir, which is a tech company.
Yeah.
Very nationally known, very well known. There are issues there as well. I believe the state pension fund.
And that's AI for those that are out there listening. And AI is scaring the britches off a lot of us right now. And
exactly.
And that's one of the companies we're afraid of.
Right, exactly. So there is a lot in the state pension fund. A lot of these are funds that are picked out by people that are contracted by the state, but not necessarily the state controller himself. But he does have final approval on where this money goes and then how it is managed, so to say. This is the money that's part of the public pension system. So these are pensions for public workers. It's not for you or I, despite being public radio. So they are making an issue out of that. I'm curious if voters actually care all that much about those investments, to be honest with you. I think that it looks good for certain headlines, but at the end of the day, I don't know if you explain the entire pension system to them. I don't know if that's going to be the deciding issue. I think the more effective argument for these candidates is going to be, I'm going to use the office to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Which one of them wants to use $10 billion of the pension fund to finance affordable housing development. Those are the kind of proposals that they want to see from DiNapoli, but haven't seen.
Mm. And of course, the pension tier six is a negotiating point right now in the legislature. And the, you know, we just watched the tier one, two, three. Once you got past four, you went, are they getting anything for their pension? And now we're at six. I mean, you know, the benefits have gone way down.
They have gone way down. And it's a huge sticking point for state workers. Though I will say, when you ask state workers, you know, what is causing you to be hired or retained, it's not necessarily the pension.
No,
it's more of the
healthcare, right?
Very nice benefits that they continue to get.
Yeah.
That being said, these localities want workers to stay in these jobs for a long time. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you want a competitive pension system. The problem being that if they switch this now, it's going to cost more money just naturally as a result. Now, who pays that money? Is it the state paying that money, or is it these localities that then have to foot the bill? That's the big tension in this conversation.
Yeah. Well, there's always tension in any political conversation we have surrounding New York State. And the person to do it with is Dan Clark. He is the author of The Capital Confidential from the Times Union. Find out more at timesunion.com or capitalconfidential.com. Dan, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. I know we'll be back talking again, and nothing will be solved.
Nothing will ever be solved, but thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.